Today's Thursday, April 24th, 2025. Today, the Replaceables are joined in the studio by Frankfurt's own Myra Elias to discuss the maritime history of the Slyfield family in Northwest Michigan. The month of April is sometimes referred to as Shipwreck Month, particularly within the Great Lakes region. Today's guest is a member of the Slyfield family. Myra's great-great-grandfather was Alonzo J. Slyfield, medical doctor, and he was also the lighthouse keeper on South Manitou Island for 6 years and at Point Betsy for 22 years, for a total of 28 years. Her great-great-grandfather, Charles B. Slyfield, along with two of his younger brothers, Elmer and George, owned and operated a steam tug boat in Frankfurt for 23 years. Charles B. Slyfield's youngest son and Myra's great uncle was Charles O. Samp Slyfield, an early ship to shore radio operator for the first Marconi radio station, WFK, set up on the Great Lakes in Alberta. So good morning, Myra, and welcome to the Woo Woo Studio in beautiful Alberta. We're very pleased you expressed an interest, I don't know if that was an interest, willingness. It's
better. An arm twisting.
To share a little about the Slyfield family's Northwest Michigan maritime history with our listeners this morning.
So we want to start with your great-great-grandfather, Alonzo J. Slyfield. Now, he was born on June 1st, 1825, and he got married on December 10th, 1848. So I guess he was about 23 years old. Does that sound right? Yeah, 23 years old to Alice Jane Latham. And she was born on May 26, 1826, so they were very close in age. Could you tell us a little bit about where and when Alonzo J. Slyfield was born and raised?
The information that I have to share is that he was born in Washington, Vermont. So I assume that Washington may have been the county or a town there. I'm not sure. And he spent his early years in St. Clair, Michigan. The family migrated from Vermont to St. Clair, Michigan. And the township that they reference a lot in the books that I have and the things that they've written, it was in China Township, which was kind of interesting. And I believe that's where he and Alice met, because her family also lived in that area.
So I know there's a new China that's kind of close to New Baltimore and right on the Anchor Bay and all that, so that kind of makes a lot of sense. Can you tell us where he received his medical training?
He actually worked as an apprentice back in Vermont under Dr. A. Morse, M-O-R-S-E. I tried to find out more about that doctor over the last few weeks since I knew I was coming here. And interestingly, there's a junior and a senior, and I believe this was the senior, but he studied under his guidance and did research on his own among the native Indians and the tribes in that region, and gained knowledge there on the herbs and roots that could be used. And I actually have in my possession some formulas that he made up for cures for different ailments that people may have had in his own handwriting. I still have those, and I framed some of them. And it's really, really interesting, the early approach to medicine that they were forced to use, because that it was rudimentary. It was just beginning. And
so after being married for about 5 years, your great-great-grandfather, who was a medical doctor, got a job as the South Manitou Island lighthouse keeper in August of 1853. To us, that seemed a little bit strange. Why would somebody with medical training want to become a lighthouse keeper? Because we looked up the pay rate for a lighthouse keeper back in 1840, and You got paid $365 a year. So it's almost like you're getting a dollar a day to be the lighthouse keeper. So maybe you could help us understand that a little.
That was a good question when you posed it to me, and I didn't know the answer. And so I did a little background work of my own and found out that Alonzo's father died of cholera when he was young. Alonzo, I think, was about 14, and his mother remarried subsequently. She married a captain, a boat captain, Phineas Kenyon Sr., who was involved in the newly developing Great Lakes shipping industry. His sons were boat captains and shipbuilders, and I assume that they had a great deal of influence on him, he and his wife both, regarding being on the Great Lakes and working. I also found out that it was a political, I thought, how does someone get an appointment? Okay. It was a political appointment, and it's a return, I'm sorry to say, for political favors. And I don't know what they were. I didn't go any further.
It's like the old spoils system. We're going to get you this position here.
Yes. And that, because I thought, how do you apply for this job in those days? Right. And that's what I was able to research and find out that was.
I think it would be interesting, too, what would be the training? It was on the job with the previous lighthouse keeper?
I don't think there was a great deal of training. There were some requirements that you had to be able to read and write, and that I found anyway, and able to lift a certain amount of weight and be able to operate a boat.
Wow.
And beyond that, it was on the job training, I think.
Wow.
It seems.
So it's our understanding that Dr. Slyfield stayed as lighthouse keeper on the South Manitou Island for 6 years. Did that kind of line up with what you're seeing, basically?
Yes. And I did, I found my cousin of mine, Sherry Reich, actually wrote a fair amount about their life when they left St. Clair County and began the duties as lighthouse keeper on South Manitou, and what the building was like, how decrepit the conditions were, how difficult it was. There was almost no one living there. Just a few woodcutters were along the way, a few natives, and a scattering of farmers, just very, very basic. There wasn't any social life, you would say, on South Manitou in those days.
I guess those woodcutters are kind of critical because all these ships were kind of wood-burning kind of ships, steamships, and they needed that wood. So I guess that's the only one of the only places you'd be able to stop going from north of here on the way to Chicago to pick up wood, which you would need as fuel.
Right. And that was indicated in the research that she did, that it was a main shipping route, Manitou Passage, and that's where they refueled. Was on South Manitou, and so that was somewhat of an industry, I guess you could say, in the early days, to supply the wood. But he wasn't involved in that as far as I know.
Did Alonzo Slyfield keep a journal?
He did, but he didn't keep it. I don't have anything that he kept on South Manitou. What I have is what he began keeping once he was at Point Betsy.
Okay.
So if there was an earlier one, I have never seen it.
Do you know what the population of South Manitou Island during his tenure?
No, I tried to find that answer as well for you. It was just a scattering of people, like I mentioned. There wasn't really settlement yet.
Did he provide any medical care for anyone beyond providing first aid for survivors of shipwrecks in his
Absolutely.
Own family?
Absolutely. On South Manitou, I don't know about his activity, but at Point Betsy, very definitely, when they lived there, the 22 years that he was there, did a lot of that.
Well, we'll get more into
that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it was kind of a family affair then. Yeah, you've got a wife and kids and all that there. I imagine there must have been some homeschooling going on if there wasn't a school there.
Was there?
No. Okay. No, not on South Manitou. They homeschooled, but they were really young children then, too. They were very young. So.
Were there any U.S. life-saving service surfmen assigned to the South Manitou Island while your great-great-grandfather was the lighthouse keeper? Or was he the only rescuer available in the event of a shipwreck?
Interestingly enough, they housed a crew of men, I don't know how large a crew was, that was rebuilding the keeper's quarters, and provided, you know, housing for them and meals and that sort of thing as they did that restoration work. And then they were also expected to assist on any wreckage that came along or any saving that was required. So they did double duty there, too. They were builders and rescuers.
Okay. So how did the lighthouse keeper communicate with the outside world? I understand there's no electricity there at this point in time and certainly no telephone. I don't imagine there's any radio. So they would these ships come often enough to send messages out to different places?
I believe that was their only mode of communication. Mm-hmm. There, it doesn't seem to be any other possible way to communicate other than with the ships that came you know, really, I don't know, perhaps with the Native Indians, if there were people that were going back and forth from the Leland area to South Manitou, which was sort of the shortest distance, I believe, there may have been able, they may have been able to send communications back like that by going to the mainland, but other than that, there weren't any.
Mm. Yeah. And really, back at that time, there was no real good highways or anything around Michigan, so a lot of the commerce and all that was by the waters, and from what we were reading, it sounds like up to 100 ships a day could have gone through this Manitou passage.
Okay,
so that's pretty brisk traffic for back in the 1800s, I would think. Are you able to describe a typical day of the lighthouse keeper at the South Manitou Island when Alonzo and his family were stationed there from 1853 to 1859?
I'm not, actually. I have a brief idea, a sketch of how difficult it must have been when I read about his wife giving birth on the island, essentially alone, and the conditions of the housing that they were living in, that day-to-day life. I think that they just went. They were only able to manage day to day. You know, I don't know. It sounds like they had some crops that they tried to grow and that sort of thing, but I don't know, even know really how they ever got enough food to manage.
Well, and then to have a group of men there.
Right.
So her workload must
never
have
ended.
Been tremendous.
It never ended. Yeah.
Wow.
So would you like to read us that passage, or did you want us to read the passage about
No,
that?
I can.
You could do that.
Oh, right. This was June 8th, 1854. It's snowing in June 8th, so think about that.
How is that possible?
There's no electricity in the South Manitou Lighthouse, set on a sandy knoll near Lake Michigan shore, nor in the rudimentary stone keeper's quarters below it. The short rubble stone house is deteriorating, the eaves rotting, and the fireplace has collapsed. Outside, the snow falls to 6 or so inches before the rain begins, and the J.J. Shaman is washing ashore in the storm. Inside, Alice Slyfield was giving birth to her second child, Charles B. Slyfield. Alonzo is on the watch when he sees the brig come in and rushes to help the passengers get from the ship to the land. It's only after he returns to the lighthouse, along with the shipwrecked crew, that he learns his son has been born.
In 1859, decided to resign his post as lighthouse keeper on South Manitou Island. Have you got an idea why he might have thought about resigning at that point in time?
The best that I can come up with was the isolation, no doubt, for he and his wife. New house or not, I have an excerpt from a study that was done by my cousin. It reads, new house or not, both Alonzo and Alice had had enough of a South Manitou light lifestyle by then. And he resigned in the spring of 1859 to take up farming on the mainland on 160 acres just north of Empire, north of North Bar Lake. When I was a really small child, my mother always took us there to North Bar Lake. It's still a favorite spot for me to go. but there are remnants that she pointed out that she believed to be part of the farm. I'm not positive that that's accurate, but they did farm there for several years. They grew crops on this property, cleared it, built the house, built crops, but there was no market for it. And so they ultimately ended up feeding the crops to their animals to sustain that part of their life and that sort of thing, but it really didn't offer them any income. So when an opening became available, or when he learned of an opening at Point Betsy, it seems at that point he decided to move again and go down to start a job at Point Betsy.
So Point Betsy Lighthouse was built in 1858. What I have is on September 9th, 1861, the family began their move to Point Betsy Lighthouse. Could you describe the process to our listeners?
Well, from what I've been able to research, it talks about how they, in the diaries and that sort of thing, how they loaded their belongings and livestock on a bit of a barge, if you would. Not a large barge. It was handmade, I'm sure. And they pulled it along the shoreline from North Bar Lake toward Point Betsy. They pulled it on shore. I mean, I don't know if they pulled it by horse or by hand, but it somehow it floated out. And they were transporting things that way. But when they got to the Platte River, the wind picked up a bit. And they were able to sail the rest of the way to Point Betsy, which made the trip much easier for them.
Oh, could it make it easy?
Well,
with animals. I mean, I'm just curious how many animals.
I don't know how many trips they made. They possibly made more than one trip on. I don't know how large this vehicle for transportation may have been. I don't know.
Wow. It sounds similar to how people used to come into Frankfurt and they'd throw the cattle overboard and let them swim to the shore because we didn't have any Mackinac Island ferry to work with here.
No.
So for 21 years, the Slyfield's growing family kept the light on at Point Betsy. Can you describe how it was a family affair and not just Alonzo doing all the work?
Well, it was primarily a family affair because he was called out a lot for medical calls and to get supplies for the house just to reach, you know, to get food and lumber that they needed. So he was away. So his wife was required to step into that role, and his sons, his children that were there to help to keep the light burning and to do whatever the other chores were associated with keeping the lighthouse maintained.
Mm-hmm. And these are kerosene lights. You've got to keep filling those, and then when they're off during the daytime, there's probably a lot of cleaning involved, I would think, to keep the lens in any kind of shape so it can be seen at a distance. How did life at Point Betsy differ from life on the South Manitou Island?
I can only imagine that there were a lot of similarities that may not have been all that different, except there were the possibly more interaction with people available at Point Betsy. There were neighbors, and they did, he did interact with other families as far as, like, they shared animals, they shared horses for work and that sort of thing. They worked together cutting fences and lumber. The men did, again, leaving his wife and children alone at the lighthouse to keep it going as it needed to.
So sounds like a little more of a community, even if it's some distance away.
Right.
So were the Slyfield kids actually able to attend a formal school at all in that area, or is that still too early?
At one point, I read that he took them by sled or horse wagon to Benzonia, and they boarded them, two of the children, for the school year with a family. It was in a log cabin, of course, and I don't know who took care of them or how they made that arrangement, but they left them there for the school year and then went back in the spring to retrieve them to come home for summer. And I think that only went on two or three years, And then there was other opportunity in Frankfurt that came up on a very small scale. But
you know. So how old were, do you know how old the kids?
I'm not really sure. School age.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm sure that helped my great-grandmother, too, in some ways, to have fewer children to care for. During right. that, you know, I mean, realistically, even though...
But then you lose your helpers.
Your helpers would be, yeah, your helpers would be wow. elsewhere.
Wow.
But meals and laundry and things would be
less.
Diminished.
Of course, I don't think they had that many clothes.
No, they didn't. And, yeah. Yeah.
So during the same period, this is when Lincoln would have been riding the circuit in order to have enough legal work in Illinois to keep, you know, his career going. So your great-great-grandfather being a physician, did he have to do a lot of traveling to get to the patients in that region and provide them with medical care?
Right. He, according to what he had written, I mean, he traveled basically the whole, as far as Traverse City, Platte River, that area, Frankfurt. I don't hear any, or I didn't read anything about going south of here for any reason. But he traveled all seasons, making calls on the sick, and how he even knew about it, I'm not sure. People came to him with a request, so they traveled a long way too, just to have him get the news, or somehow he received the news that someone was sick, and then he would go. And it was always by horseback or snowshoeing in the winter to get there. I have one of his snowshoes yet that he made, or that was made during that time at my house. The mate to it has been lost over the decades, but I have it proudly hanging on my wall and can't imagine using it to go very many miles.
So do you have any passages by chance, you know, during this time, or any other things about your great-grandfather that you want to, before we move on to your...
Oh, I see what you're
great-grandfather.
Saying.
Yeah.
I don't have, actually. That is, you know, basically the experience as I've been told or I've been able to read about it. Yeah.
What a fascinating man.
He was the
and
coroner.
And his wife.
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
Well, yeah. He was the coroner and justice of the peace as well.
So when did that?
Frank, I don't know
was
the
that
date.
Later?
When he was on the mainland, of course. You know, so he was called out in many directions. The History of Frankfurt is a book that's available at the library, and I have a copy at home. In there, it talks about his work as coroner in the community, and he served as like a magistrate, and he was quite involved in that particular process.
Yeah, you've got to imagine somebody with his expertise, you'd want them available to tell you what's the cause of death in this case, because there probably wasn't many physicians around at that point in time,
no.
I don't imagine.
No.
So now we're going to move on to the son of Alonzo Slyfield, which was Charles B. Slyfield. And Myra earlier had read the account of Charles's birth. Charles B. Slyfield was born on June 8, 1854, he married Lucetta Oliver, who was born 5/2/1884.
Well, that's when they were married.
That was when they were married. Sorry.
We don't know her birthday, I'm sorry to say, but we do know
okay.
they got married.
Sorry,
a
little
we probably
confused.
Have it somewhere.
Okay. My question to you is, Lucetta, is she part of the Paul Oliver family?
No. And it's odd that the name, you know, would be in the community and not be related, but to best of my knowledge, she wasn't.
Okay. Yeah. So where did her family come? Do you know?
That's okay. That's okay.
Okay.
I have it at home, I'm sure.
Okay. Can you describe how Charles B. Slyfield's early experiences at both the South Manitou Island and Point Betsy Lighthouse led to his growing interest in maritime activities?
I'm left to imagine that his father was a big influence along the way with their life. And the experiences gained by working with his father, helping his father, perhaps generated that interest for him in maritime activities. Additionally, there wasn't a lot of other options. to do like there are today. I mean, so that was probably a likely path that was open to him that he would be able to go.
So we have read that for 23 years, Charles B. Sleinfeld, your great-grandfather, and his two of his younger brothers, Elmer and George, operated and owned the steam tug E.D. Halton in Frankfurt. Can you tell us how the boat got its name at all and describe the type of work that was done with it?
Yeah, the boat was built in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in 1874, and it was named after or in honor of the first sheriff in that community, an early settler and businessman, and he was Ed Halton. It was sold in 1889 to, one account says the Sleinfeld brothers, and another says their sister Jessie. So I'm not sure what was going on there, but somehow the boat made it to Frankfurt, where they used it for all those years. It was 56 feet long, the tug, 13 feet wide, I believe. So it was a fairly good size. And when it got to Frankfurt, they went to work and did a lot of rebuilding on it to put additional engines on it to make it more serviceable for tugboat usage. If boats needed to be pulled in from Lake Michigan, they needed more horsepower, so to speak. And so they made the boat stronger and bigger and more able to conduct that work. And as far as I know, that's how they used the tug in this community. It wasn't used in the bay necessarily, but it would have been used in the Great Lakes to help bring boats in that needed assistance.
And they were involved with some fishing, were they too?
A great deal of fishing. Yeah, they kept extensive ledgers on the netting. They were netting in those days. And the volume of fish that they brought in is unbelievable compared to today's standards when we think about it. Tons of them. And how they processed them, put them in barrels often. They shipped them to Chicago when they were able to get that passage. And that's how they made their livelihood.
Okay, and Charles and Lucenta bought two lots at the corner of Forest and Second, where they built a home. And I think the address was 123 Forest. Right. And they'd reside there for the remainder of their lives. We've even seen a picture of, I think, your mom on the porch with your grandfather there.
Yeah.
So did you ever get to visit that house?
Well, actually, I did many times. The home, not, of course, while they were living there, but my mother and father bought the home when it became available in the mid-60s, I believe it was, and they kept it as a short-term rental, which it had been used for extensively up until that point, where my grandparents would move to the small cottage that they had built behind the house and rent out their home in the summertime. It was actually termed the Sleinfeld Cottage. It wasn't a cottage, it was a home, a full-size house. But my grandmother and grandfather would move to, great-grandparents would move to the back cottage. She would take care of the house, feed the people, cook for them, that sort of thing, as another way to make a living.
Wow.
That's what they did. So I visited there many times, and it was owned by the family until the 1980s when my mother sold it.
So your mother was Dorothy A. Anderson. Did she ever describe visiting her parents on Forest and what it was like there back in the day?
Yeah, she. I only recall one memory that she shared with me and told me how her mother, who lived here in South Frankfurt at the time, would load her up on, bundle her up in the wintertime, and they would skate. She'd put her on a sled and skate across the bay to visit her grandmother, or my grandmother, the mother and father. They would go across, and that's the only thing that Mama ever shared with me regarding her interaction with her grandparents. I know that, again, from the picture that you mentioned earlier, she apparently did spend time with them, but In the winter, it was just easier to go across the bay on the ice.
You said that they lived in South Frankfort, which is Alberta. Mm-hmm. Where in South Frankfort was their home?
It's right behind here. It's the house with the fieldstone porch.
Okay. Oh.
That's where my mother was born,
okay.
I'm told.
That's a beautiful house there. I know eventually your family moved out of state, but you'd always come back in the summer. Was there a family residence somewhere that you'd return to during the summer months, or how did all that work?
Yes. Fortunately, in 1953, my parents were able to obtain the small cottage that my great-grandparents would move into in the summertime.
Okay.
And it's on Harbor Place, right behind 123 Forest. And so my parents bought that cottage, and they started bringing us here, my sisters and I, every summer until I obtained the cottage, actually in the 80s, I was able to buy it. But my mother was a school teacher, my dad was a farmer, and so when school was out, Mom would load us up, and we'd come to the cottage, and Dad would come between crops.
Where did you come from? Like, where were you living?
Ida, Michigan. It's okay. Near Monroe, right? Ah. It was a family farm down there, up very rural.
What kind of things did you grow there on that farm?
They had soybeans and corn, wheat, and feeder cattle and pigs. Yeah. Well, we had just kind of a general farm. It wasn't very big. I think it was 120 acres or something like that. But my father did the farming. Like I said, my mother was an assistant, taught school, and assisted him on the farm. And he also had a job as a factory worker in Monroe.
So in the summer, he could not leave. Did she take you up?
Yes, Mom would drive us up.
Yeah, I was going to say, he would have to, summer is
between crops,
farming.
Yeah. If, okay. if the crops were harvested and finished, then he would come up for a week or so and then go back. And we went home during the summer, but not for very long. The love and the attraction was the Frankfort Beach, and we stayed pretty close there.
Yes, I bet.
Yeah.
Wow. We're going to pick up talking about our third Samp Slyfield, Charles O. Okay, he was born in Frankfort, 5/11, 1898, and was a 1916 Frankfort High School graduate who had been the radio supervisor for the Ann Arbor Railroad for several years and operated a radio school in his home. His nickname was Samp Slyfield, played a big role in both the Great Lakes and Frankfort, Alberta radio history.
You probably got to meet your uncle, did you, at some point?
Actually, I never did.
Never did.
I heard about him very, very often. My mother would talk about him. My grandmother, he was her brother. My grandmother would talk about him. He visited Frankfort, of course, but I wasn't living here at the time. I hadn't moved here yet and full time. And okay. So if I met him, I was a very small child, and I don't recall ever having. But he was like a celebrity in the family. Mm-hmm. When his name was mentioned, everyone paid attention.
So the radio station was WFK, and the FK, I think, stood for Frankfort, but technically the station was in Alberta. But I think a lot of things back in the day that were in Alberta were kind of attributed to Frankfort, since it was a big metropolitan area here. And he actually, we understand, installed vacuum tube equipment on many of the car ferries that sailed between Frankfort and the various ports so that they would be able to communicate with him in the event of an emergency. And that all happened in the mid-1920s. Are you familiar with any of that kind of activity?
No, truthfully not. I had never heard of a vacuum tube until I spoke with the two of you. I tried to look up a little bit about it, but I have no knowledge other than something that I pulled off of the internet that talks about when he started the service, assisted the car ferry number 4 in 1923 during that wreckage, I read. And they used a rotary type spark gap in 1915, which means nothing to me. I don't understand that.
So that would be even prior, I think, to the vacuum tube. They did that first, then they moved into the vacuum tubes. When I was growing up, they had a transistor radio, so we were really way into the future.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that he was involved with everything that early on. And he that led to your uncle's, well, he had a first-class, the first first-class license for radio, I think, on the Great Lakes, too. So he's kind of like a big guy in Great Lakes history. That was the first one ever issued in this region. So I know Dave Beaton and everybody in the station want to learn as much about them as they can. They were walking around up in the hills, and they found a cement slab where I think the radio tower used to sit here in Alberta, and he wants to turn that into some kind of a national monument. So we'll see how he does on that. But he had so much success as a radio operator and working with sound that he ended up moving to Disney, the Disney Film Recording Company, in 1930 and becoming the sound director for Walt Disney Productions. So, I mean, he was involved with all the early...
Well, she can tell us.
Well, just...
Yes.
Anytime we went to a movie, I know that we had to watch your credits, watch for the credits, so find his name more than the movie was secondary. if he was involved at all, my mother made sure that we paid attention to the credits along the way. I don't know how he ever learned of an opportunity on the West Coast in California with Disney in those days, when you think about it, communication being what it was. I do know that his wife had recently passed away in 1928, and I'm wondering if it may have been a way for him to just get away from that and to start into something new.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking for his wife to pass away so early after their marriage. And so he moved to California. And there was a couple other people, actually, that were from Frankfurt that ended up in California, too. So it almost sounds like he had an entourage.
I think there was more that he didn't necessarily go alone, that Robert Cook was also a sound man. And from Frankfurt, I believe, and I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to think or could imagine that they teamed up and made the trip across the country together.
Wow.
I don't know.
Yeah, there was a third fellow named Greer, too, that also ended up there. So it's quite a story. We first became aware of him when we were reading through the Frankfurt Alberta Schools Hall of Fame. And he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think, in 2009, and they had a nice write-up about his early career here in radio and also his work there at Disney. So there is information out there, and we're going to have to get everything more formal. Like you, we wrote something up initially for the radio station and the radio history portion, and when we wrote it up, we didn't understand too much about vacuum tubes or spark gap kind of things and all that. And we're going to get more well-versed in it, and we're going to sound like we know what we're talking about when we come back around at some point.
Interestingly enough, Kathy Wright, who is Samp's great-granddaughter, wrote I found some information from her, and it said that when that vacuum tube equipment was installed, it made so much noise that it could actually be heard across the bay on the Frankfurt Main Street on a quiet day. So I don't know but that was contributed by his great-granddaughter, Kathy Wright.
I'm sure people did not appreciate that.
Well, they already had to contend with all the smoke and everything coming from the coal-burning ships. So
it may not have been that disruptive. Yeah, there was a lot of noise going.
She said a quiet day.
So
the weekends.
Yeah.
A question that I want to ask you. You mentioned that you had the opportunity to stay in the Point Betsy Lighthouse.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that experience?
I'd be happy to. 3 years ago, I noticed that they had renovated the Keeper's Quarters and were starting to market it at Point Betsy, and I was really interested. I'd visited there hundreds of times, but never to that degree to be in the quarters where they actually lived. So when they finally did that renovation, opened it up, I was quick to jump on the bandwagon and buy some time there. We went in the fall. It was in September, I believe, early September, so weather was very nice yet. It's difficult to explain in some ways. It just connected me even further with a whole idea. I had a greater appreciation for what they did and how they may have lived the best I could figure out. And I remember in the diary that Grandpa talked about, like, small lakes out at Point Betsy or ponds. And I never really thought much about it, except I guess casually thought, how could there be ponds out here? It's a sand dune. But then I walked around and I found them. And there is standing water in close to Point Betsy where the children would go and play, or the dog would retrieve something and bring it back. He would reference that in the diary. So I just found that interesting until I actually went out and looked. And there are some. I did find them. But the stay there it was fabulous, actually. The accommodations were great. We opened the house up quarters while we were there to any friends that wanted to come and visit, to expose it to other people. So we just generally had a really enjoyable time there.
A lot of people like to talk about the good old days, but I kind of imagine there's a lot of hard work that went into maintaining a lighthouse, even in the best of times. And it's I'd rather stay there as a vacationer, too.
So while you were there, could you go up into the lighthouse?
Like, yes.
Did you ever have to reenact anything?
No. I never talked about it when I was out there. No, I didn't do anything. I just went as a guest. Yeah.
Wow. It's quite a spiral staircase going up there. I know our granddaughter she loves to go to the lighthouse, but she won't walk up the stairway. So we got to work on her this summer.
Maybe it's a bit claustrophobic.
It's difficult to navigate. Yeah. I think I found that I went up last summer and I took my grandchildren out there, and they scampered up, of course, but I found it challenging and more so coming down. It seemed, and I can only imagine carrying buckets of oil or whatever the vessels were that it was carried in up there and managing it had to be very difficult.
Yeah, we've got a video that shows a lot of stuff about haunted lighthouses. So I imagine all that isolation, we get your imagination going in all kinds of directions, and you hear certain sounds coming from outside, and you might attribute it to some supernatural kind of being.
The Point Betsy Lighthouse Group had a haunted lighthouse event 2 years ago that I went to, and again I took the grandchildren, and it was all by candlelight and that sort of thing. So it was really interesting, and it wasn't necessarily all about a Point Betsy, but it was about lighthouses, just what you're saying in general, and the sounds and the noises and the feelings, and it was fun for us. And then we had donuts and cider afterwards, made it even better.
Yeah, and with all the shipwrecks and people being rescued, there is a certain amount of death and everything associated with that industry. So it's a challenging kind of situation to be in.
I don't think there were many happy occasions when you think about it. Like you said, it's associated with wrecks and deaths and injuries and that sort of thing. So it wasn't necessarily a pleasant thing when I think about it.
Yeah.
We pretty much covered the family history we're able to cover now, but we want to talk a little about the Manitou Passage Underwater Preserve. So there is a big section of real estate and also water that includes the North and South Manitou Islands that's actually become a preserve now. And the reason it's become a preserve is there's so many shipwrecks in that area, 50-plus shipwrecks, that it's a great place for scuba divers to go and explore shipwrecks. There was one particular shipwreck that happened on December 7th, 1854, and it was the Westmoreland shipwreck that was of note. And there was 17 souls lost right off the bat when the ship was wrecked, and there was another 17 that headed for shore. And I think when they got to shore, Carol, did you find they went in a couple different directions? They had a choice of either going to walking to Traverse City or walking to Manistee, neither which would be much fun on a December 7th in 1854, but they tended to walk along the shoreline one way or the other, and those were their choices. That particular ship, the Westmoreland, perished in very deep waters, and it ended up at the bottom of the Platte Bay, but it wasn't found, I think, till about 2010. And the ship was reputed to be carrying $100,000 in gold coins in her safe and 280 barrels of whiskey in her hold. So it sparked a long period of time people looking for the ship. And the fellow that did end up finding it on July 7th, 2010, said it would be a life-threatening experience to even try to enter the hold of the ship where you'd find all the whiskey and the safe carrying the gold coins. So I would say that would be something worth seeing if you're a scuba diver, but don't go down into the hold.
Okay, for our listeners, we are so lucky to have Myra Elias with us in the studio. And she's been talking to us about the Slyfield family maritime experience. And I had asked her at the break if she had an excerpt from a journal or notes that she would like to read. Do you, Myra?
I do. It's from Charles B. Slyfield, and it's written May 9th, 1912, as he concludes the journal that he kept at that point. And he said, "I have put the best working days of my life on the tug, having been her engineer for 23 years, and now I'm left in my old age without any employment and no way of making a living in sight. But suppose there will something turn up to help me out. I've always managed to live in the past as the lot has always been, not extreme poverty nor riches, but enough to live uncomfortably, comfortably by using economy at all times." Mm-hmm. So that was sort of his summary of his life.
Wow.
Said it corresponds with my life exactly up to the present time. He termed himself an old man, and I don't think he was really that old in 1912, but I guess he felt old at the time.
Yeah, and I'm sure that life work took a toll on one's body.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and the life expectancy back then isn't quite what it was today. So,
no. We'd like to thank you, Myra, for coming in and
You're
talking
welcome.
About the Slyfields, which is really interesting because people, you know, people are interested in this mm-hmm. area, and to be able to have access. Oh, you know, something I wanted to ask you: do you have? Are some of these artifacts and things from the family in a museum here?
Some of the things are out of Point Betsy. Alonzo's medical bag was in my mother's keeping, and I inherited that along the way. And when John Hawley asked me about it, I showed it to him, and he wondered if he could have it. And I'm like, no, my mother wouldn't like that. But then he approached me again later and convinced me that it would be safe in Point Betsy. And so it's on display out there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there other things?
I do have some handmade hooks that they used, which are unbelievable gaffs that they've forged out somehow with their fishing. And I mean, they typically netted. I was just noticing this in the diary while you were speaking, that like 116,000 pounds at a time would not be uncommon of trout, whitefish, and how they then sold it. And when the market went down, that forced them to sell the tug because the business wasn't good enough anymore to maintain it. They could only
Wow, interesting.
So that's part of it. Yeah.
So all of the artifacts and different historical are at Point Betsy?
No. Well, I kept the fishing equipment at my house. I have it on display at my home.
Okay.
But Point Betsy has the doctor's medical
Super.
Bag.
Well, we'll have to get out there and take
a
look at it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not very big. It's not extensive at all.
Yeah.
And still has the line attached to the suturing thread attached to some needles and things.
Wow.
It's pretty rudimentary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.